Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nicholas Kapman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as CMC. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com to check us out and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Carlos. And Carlos, could you pronounce your last name for me?
Sure, it's Jurasek.
Jurasek. All right, Carlos Jurasek. Very nice to bring you on the podcast. Appreciate you taking the time. And why don't we start off by having you introduce yourself and your background?
Thanks, Nick. So yeah, thank you for the invitation. Really looking forward to the discussion. I've spent about 30 years or so in the pharma and biotech industry, focused in on really compliance and operational excellence, kind of combining the two. So it's this topic of having phase-appropriate quality systems, like we're going to discuss, is really something that kind of comes close to my interest in bringing those two things together.
Okay, phase-appropriate quality systems. So how would you define that?
So I think the first thing is we should really frame the discussion that in the biotech industry, right, we have this responsibility to get products to the clinic, get products into commercial as quickly as possible for patients who are waiting. Right? So I think it's that background. Because sometimes people will look at quality systems by design or phase-appropriate quality systems as a way of maybe reducing only costs. But the importance really is to get things to the clinic as quickly as patients, right? So under that sort of umbrella, then we can discuss what is a phase-appropriate quality system. And from my perspective, it's a quality system that is designed specifically to address the needs of process development in the early phases.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
And what would you say is the regulatory basis for that?
Well, first of all, so the FDA, at least in the US, right, has specifically excluded phase one manufacturing from 210 to 11, right, as the GMPs are codified in the Code of Federal Regulations. At the same time, they published a guidance, right, GMPs for phase one products, right, announcing that they are excluding phase one products from the 210 to 11, providing guidance on what they're seeing. And in their own words, is to streamline, right, and promote the development of new products. Right? So they want to do this that can move quickly into the clinic.
Mm-hmm. And when we think about the fact that phase one is excluded, and then we think about phase two and phase three, how would you describe the scrutiny or the level of compliance in those different phases?
Yeah, so I think that the way to look at it, well, first of all, I think we should probably take a look a little bit about, yeah, the FDA has excluded those from the regulations, right? But they still have oversight. Sure, right? So the way that the FDA is going to look at those things is making sure that we are very detailed in our INDs, and they will hold us accountable to how we describe the processes and analytical testing and all that within the IND. The other piece, though, that is still important is that even though 210, 211 do not apply, the Cosmetic Act does. Right, so we're still, it's technically still adulterated if you don't manufacture appropriately, that the product doesn't have the quality and attributes that you purport to have in the IND, is still adulterated, right? So just background, right? So it's not free for all.
Mm-hmm. So has the agency explained the intention of kind of using the cosmetics as opposed to 210 to 11?
Right.
Obviously, so you talked about the adulteration, but I wanted to see if you could explain that a little bit more.
Cosmetic Act.
Yeah.
Sure, of course. So I think from the beginning, the commissioner, back in 1978, when the original GMPs were actually published, they specifically indicated that it would apply to research product. They left the door open to say that, hey, we're going to probably propagate new regulations for research products. But that never really happened, right? So it was all really about the FDA making their own judgments along the way. But then finally, like in 2008, they finally amended 210 to specifically exclude the phase one, right? And then they published the guidance at the same time. Mm-hmm. So they, so it's been a kind of a long time coming because it's taken so long for them to really come around this. But again, they want us to be able to use this flexibility to bring the products quickly to the clinic.
Mm-hmm. What are some development perspectives for this approach?
Sure. I mean, I think that if we look at analytical testing, for instance, as an example, as a starting point for discussion, if we are going to move these products from research into development, and we're going to do that quickly, that means there's a lot of variability that is still going to be present, right? And we're going to need to be looking out for that. And where does that variability come from, right? It could be your equipment, your sampling, your sample preparation, your reagents, right? And you need to have a way of maybe continuing to learn about those assays while you're actually getting the products to that phase one clinical.
Mm-hmm. Are there implications for the preclinical production?
Sure. So I think that that's a really good point. So before we get into the phase one, we obviously have to do the tox material, right? And do everything that is actually governed under part 58. Now, those regulations haven't really been amended since like 1970 or it's been a while since those play amended. But what's really important is that material that is manufactured needs to be consistent with what we put into the clinic, right? Because the basis for the safety part of the argument that we're making that this is safe to bring into the clinic is based on that preclinical material. So if you can't manufacture that consistently, right, and you don't have that well characterized, then it's going to be very difficult for us to be able to do comparability and do the changes that we're going to need to make as we continue to evolve the process, right? Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, we really should have those quality systems extending back to preclinical manufacturing. Often you'll find that companies will manufacture that by one team or maybe under close to GMP type of situations. And that's really risky, right? We really should be able to manufacture these things under basically the same controls that you have for the clinical manufacturing, if we can use these space appropriate GMP.
Hmm. What are the...
But let me back up a little bit, Nick. I think that...
Go ahead.
So I was going to back up a little bit because I think that analytical assays, like I described, is definitely one of those areas that is going to require us to look for variability. But that's also going to happen in the process, of course. Right? So in the process, we bring the process into menu. You're going to get variability that is not expected, and you need to capture those things. Right? So again, it's a risk of us from a manufacturing perspective to figure out, okay, how we're going to capture those observations or concerns without creating a bunch of deviations, right? Because we know that the process is going to be varying because it's not finished, it's not validated. But how do you capture it's going to be part of that quality system, right? And we can talk about it a little bit more in detail.
Makes sense. What are the implications for early clinical production?
Right. So again, so as we bring those processes into manufacturing, and we can see that there's going to be a lot of observations, there's going to be things that the team was not aware of. And we need to provide those teams with the ability to actually capture those things, right? It's got to be part of the quality system itself to be able to capture those things, be able to learn from them, right? But not create a bunch of deviations that are not going to provide a lot of value. So the nuance is, how do you do that, right? So for example, a change control system, right? In later phases, you may not expect a lot of changes, but your change control system in the early phases should be expecting lots of changes, right? It should be able to handle those things and be able to implement those really fast, right? So it's a completely different approach to later phase manufacturing, later phase change control. In the early phases, you're likely going to have a lot more involvement from SMEs, right? Process and analytical development folks need to be available, right? And as soon as something comes up, they need to be able to make almost real-time decisions, right? To keep the processes going and to have that control that we need, knowing that the process is not validated or the analytical methods are not validated, you need to be able to react to those things quickly, right? So I could argue that change control is the most important quality system for early phases. And that may not be the case in later phases where, you know, processes pretty much settle down. We don't expect major changes. We don't have to assess so much.
Have industry groups like PDA published examples?
Yeah, so the best example that there is out there right now is this TR56 or Technical Report 56. And it's basically it's the application of phase appropriate quality systems for therapeutic proteins. Now, obviously, that's not applicable everywhere, but the concept is really good. And you can use it to kind of design your quality systems to ramp up as you go through the development phases. They also have a white paper that goes along with that technical report. And there's at least a couple of books that they've published on the topic.
Excellent. How should companies approach the early phases of production?
So I think that what's important when we talk about the quality system design is to take into account the culture and risk tolerances for the company, for the patients that you're treating, right? And there's a big difference between the risks that are going to be taken for a disease that is critical, right? These patients may have very little time. And if you have something that potentially could work, we need to get that really fast. And the FDA will allow a lot more uncertainty for those products than something that may be addressing more of a chronic disease or something that where there's maybe other options available. In those cases, you know, there's a lot less leniency as far as what variability you would be allowed, right? So I think for each company, you know, what is the culture about risk management and risk taking in that? What does the patient population look like? What is the disease that we're looking at? And you really need to design something that is specific around all that, all those variables.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
One other thing I just wanted to kind of gloss over again is, I know one of the questions I get time and time again is, as people are entering into phase two or phase three, mm-hmm. You know, there's this concern that they don't get into a commercial level GMP style of a quality system. And so, I think the concern is that they've had experiences in the past where they've said, hey, I need a quality system, I'm going into phase two or phase three. And right. Wouldn't you know, they have a commercial level quality system. So, you know, how would you, what type of advice would you give somebody that's exiting phase one so that they can avoid a commercial level but still be in compliance?
Yeah, so you know, there's an old saying, right? Smooth is slow. Well, slow is smooth, right? And smooth is fast. That's really the thing. So I think the more work that we do up front to try to really understand the process, understand those analytical methods, understand the supply chain and how that's all going to work, the smoother the later phases go. Right. And the way to do that, though, is really to design these quality systems early to capture as much learning as possible. I think that that's really the difference. It's like when you're in the early phases, the goal should be to learn, right? It's not about control. It's not about deviations. And it's not about doing all that kind of root cause analysis. It's more understand where that comes from. And the more you do that, the better it is in the end, right? Because the final ramp from phase two to three and then to commercial should be a lot smoother if you've spent the time early to actually learn, right? So those are the keys. But I'll give you an example, right? So if you have really beautiful batch records in early phases, right? Really detailed, really well designed for a process that's very variable. Those things don't match, right? So what happens is that you get all these deviations. You start writing in deviations and you get this just burden of deviation writing for really no value because you know the process is variable. So instead, you really should be designing batch records, for example, to capture a lot of that learning. Capture the learning, figure out if they need to make process changes, and then keep going. But don't burn yourself with a lot of deviations, as an example. Another example, for instance, is around training qualifications. In early phases, you really need people with a lot more understanding about the science, right? Then later phases, once this, everything's stable, then you can just deal with people that can just be more like an operator. But in the early phases, you need a lot more collaboration between process development and manufacturing. And in fact, it's often really great to cross-train them, right? Operator, so they can live in each other's worlds, right? So the analytical people or development people can work in manufacturing and vice versa. And if you have this sort of like mesh between the two, it becomes a lot easier to learn from all that experience, right?
Makes sense.
Yep.
Well, this has been really informative. What would you like to leave the audience with before we close?
I think it's important to look at all the quality systems across the board, right? So every quality system that we have and really look at it from that lens, right? What are we doing in early phases to learn, but to go fast, right? It's a balance between development work and the speed and cost necessary to get to the clinic and beyond, right? Into that early phase one. So the key is have that balance. And the balance can be reached by looking at the risks that the patients and the company are willing to take, right? So higher need, we need faster. We need to get to those patients. They usually have very little time to wait for us to get there. And therefore, striking that balance between speed and development is the key for this.
Awesome. Well, this was fantastic. Really great insight. Really appreciate the time, Carlos. And, sure. You know, for everybody else, as always, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at theftagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to theftagroup.com to get in touch and feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for tuning in and we'll see y'all next time.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.